Do we have a constitution of small government? And if so, what has happened to it? These two questions lie at the heart of the Federalist Society's 2011 National Convention, which I am most pleased to welcome all of you to. At its core, these questions are really about the structural constitution, which in turn is grounded in the notion that man's nature demands specifying and limiting government power to protect freedom. Madison made the point well when he said in Federalist No. 47 that no political truth is certainly of greater intrinsic value or is stamped with the authority of more enlightened patrons of liberty than that the accumulation of all powers in the same hands, whether of one or few or many, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. To open our convention, we have with us this morning a public servant who understands this principle of limited constitutional governance and who has vigorously defended it. United States Senator Jeff Sessions is no stranger to the Federalist Society. A leader on issues respecting the judiciary and legal policy, he has served with distinction in the U.S. Senate for 15 years. Please join me in welcoming the Senator.
Thank you. Thank you. What a good group. Good group this morning. And I love the law, as I know you do, and I think we all feel a very, very deep appreciation for the exceptional nature of the American legal system. It's just nothing like it in the world. We inherited it. We've advanced it in many ways, maybe slipped in many ways. I'll suggest a few where we've slipped. But the American legal system is a marvelous thing. As a member of the Armed Services Committee and traveling around the world a lot, we try to see, you know, we can build nations. And you think you can just provide them a copy of our Constitution and that they can therefore create a legal system that some way replicates what we try to do today is so far from reality. It just can't be imagined. And I always remember the story that I think is significant that John Adams, you know, defended in Boston British soldiers before the American Revolution before a jury and got them acquitted for shooting Americans. And so I guess what I would say to you is this is a marvelous heritage we've been given. You understand it. Leonard, you and Gene and the team here at Federalist represent the best force to expand and enhance and protect and defend the most magnificent legal system the world has ever known. Is that Judge Pryor over there? Good to see you. Man, I'm nervous already now. You don't want to, actually, you do want to be in his class, but you better be prepared to study when you're at the University of Alabama and taking his class. And I'm glad he's not officially grading my remarks this morning. The American people get it. They're on our side. If you recall that President Bush, when he was campaigning for re-election, his largest applause lines consistently dealt with his values and approach to the legal system and judges in America. I think they understand where we are and the uniqueness that we have. And the ideal of the unbiased judge. I remember Justice Roberts in my office before confirmation. We talked about the neutral umpire. And I think that resonates very, very well. A judge can't be inclined to one team or another. A judge is an adjudicator of the matter before them at the time, and we expect them to be neutral. That's why they put on that black robe and take that oath to do equal justice to the poor and the rich under the laws of the United States, under the Constitution and laws of the United States. That's the oath they take, and I think it's very much the American view by the American people. However, in some of the elite law schools, some of you have matriculated through, the progressive visionaries don't see it that way. The two confirmations we've had for the Supreme Court I believe, well, they weren't easy. It was difficult for all of us. I was ranking Republican, and we wanted to engage the nominees in a serious discussion about their approach to judging, their understanding of law, their understanding of the role of a judge, and I hope we were successful in doing that. I know Leonard and your team provided, you've sent out information and position papers that were real helpful to us as we worked through that, and many of you were. I will just note to you, there are hundreds of judges being nominated on the bench, many of you from all over America. If you know things about those nominees, we'd like to hear it. And we'd like to be able to maybe raise that at the hearing if it's appropriate to do so. I will vote for 90% of the judges. I think most of our nominees, most of our senators will be voting for most of the nominees that President Obama presents. Most of them are liberal nominees, but I mean they're within the realm of justification. But sometimes we have situations in which we may not know that a judge has a record of doing things that in their past that ought to be highlighted. They should be asked about and confronted about to make sure that they're correct. So maybe you could feel free to participate in that. Recently, there appeared before me Professor Van Alstyne, who I think is at William and Mary now, and I've been quoting him on the floor of the Senate for a number of years. I wrote it down on a napkin one time when he spoke at the 11th Circuit Conference when I was United States Attorney 15, 18 years ago, and he basically said this, that if you truly respect the Constitution, if you truly value it, you will enforce it as written. The good and bad parts, he said, the parts you may not like, the parts you think are good. But if you don't enforce it all, then you don't respect the document. And I remember he closed with that quote from the preamble that concludes with, "We do ordain and establish this Constitution, not the one you might like it to be, not the one you might like it to be. But we've established this one. This is our Constitution. And judges don't get to rewrite it because they think Europe has changed its view about certain policy issues. They just don't." He was kind of surprised that I remembered that and could quote it. But he's written a law review article, which he sent me a copy of. I'm not sure what law review it is. It's not William and Mary, but it is fabulous. So it's like the fundamental core of what the Constitution and law is and how it should be interpreted. Professor Van Alstyne's law review article is super. So one of the things I was asked to deal with today is the explosion of federal criminal law. The abandonment of the ideal of limited government, and I will do that. You're going to have a panel that's going to be far more effective than I in dealing with the nitty-gritty of the events that have happened. But in my own perspective, I've seen a lot of it as a prosecutor and over the years, and I'll share with you some thoughts. We were on the floor. I was talking to a new Senator Ron Johnson, a businessman, accountant, and I said, we should have better debate about these important issues. He said, well, one reason you don't is because the government does too much. There's no way we can manage this government. It's involved in too many things, and we can't manage and know the details of all the things. As government grows larger, and as it takes control over more areas of our life and economy, it must have ever more laws to control its dominion over us, right? I mean, it's just a necessary thing. So taxes, health care, environment, these are things in which laws keep being passed after law, and then there's a loophole or somebody gets around it and they pass another law. There's a plethora of laws being passed. And this is the President Obama's progressive ideal. I got to tell you, they've always thought they know better. That's the nature of the progressive movement. They want people who direct the lives of Americans because they can direct it better than you can live it yourself. They can make decisions better than you can make decisions. And so I think the president lacks, in my opinion, sufficient respect for the limited nature of the federal government. The progressive movement sees laws and constitutions as just obstacles to keep them from doing all what's best for all of us. You know, that's what they'd like to do. So let me give you a few personal insights and perspectives that I've seen. Historically, outside of Washington, D.C., the federal government, the United States government, was represented by two, maybe three people. The government itself was represented by two, the United States Marshal and the United States Attorney. Federal judges were part of the judiciary, the neutral umpires, and decide the thing, but the executive branch was represented, and that's all there was at the founding of our country. Sheriffs, call them, you see them in Alabama, they'll still call them, here's the high sheriff. The high sheriff was the chief law enforcement officer in the area, and he was responsible for law and order in the area, and that's just kind of the way it was. I remember back reading, had a chance to read some about the Sims War in Alabama County, where my father and mother's grandparents came from in the 1890s, and they had Mr. Sims. He was a modern-day terrorist. He was really a David Koresh apocalyptic religious extremist, but he liked whiskey, and he had a whiskey still. And they wanted to... He got in a fuss with a local Baptist leader and shot him, killed him on his front porch. At least that's what the evidence tended to show. And couldn't anything be done about him. He had a house, a log cabin with slits in it for his guns. And it was very reminding me of Koresh, actually. And so they called on the marshal from Mobile, 100-something miles away. And the marshal gathers up. He had most of the marshal at that time had part-time deputies. So they come up to catch him, and they caught him, and he escaped and killed a relative of mine, a doctor, and then all this goes on. 27 people end up dying in the Sims War. But they brought him up because he was having a whiskey still, and the marshal was enforcing the liquor law, you know, like they caught Al Capone on tax evasion. But that was the jurisdiction that they had. And they needed help, and the marshal came to help them. Then when I became, sometime after I became United States Attorney, and this would have been in the late 80s, Judge Dan Thomas, a fabulous federal judge, that wonderful gentleman, was appointed by Truman, was still on the bench, senior judge. And he wanted to tell me a story, and it was an important story to him, and this is what he told me. The story was that he got a call from the Attorney General of the United States, and the Attorney General said, Judge, I need your help on something. He said, yes, sir, I'd be glad to help you. He said, Marshal Fountain won't send in his reports. And Judge said, yeah, he won't. He said, well, you talk to him and see if you can get him to send in his reports. At that time, Judge Thomas said the marshal had two deputies. So this is the 1950s. There was no presence of the FBI, the Customs, Secret Service in Alabama at that time. And so he calls in Marshal Fountain. He said, I'm not sending those blankety-blanks any reports. He's senatorially confirmed, appointed by the president. He didn't work for the attorney general. He wasn't sending in any reports. So Judge Thomas, being the wise man he was, filled out reports for him and sent them in and calmed everything down. But I guess what I'm saying to you is this is the extent of federal law enforcement in the Southern District of Alabama in the 1950s. And the United States Attorney had, I think, two assistants, and I think they were part-time in the 50s. They paid just to do part-time work. And when I became an assistant United States Attorney in 1975, I can name you the team. Ruddy Favre did the criminal. Eddie Vulovich did civil. Irvin Coleman did appellate work. And the United States Attorney tried cases like the rest of us. And I was a new assistant, and they gave me all the little work cases to prosecute. And it was a glorious time, I got to tell you. That was the office. In 1981, when I came back as United States Attorney, it was Ruddy Favre, Eddie Vulovich, E.T. Robinson, and Jenny Grenade, and me as United States Attorney. My secretary was the administrative officer and my secretary. And we tried cases. I tried them. The assistants tried them. We did good work. Now, I hate to tell you, so for the first several years under President Reagan, we didn't have any money. So it was a freeze on hiring. And so we just went to work. I'd been in the office. You know, I didn't know I was even U.S. attorney. Secretary got papers filed, I guess, that needed to be filed, and we tried cases. Put criminals in jail, protected the United States Treasury. That's what I told them. I know what Ronald Reagan sent me here for. Protect the United States Treasury, put criminals in jail. That's what we were going to do. I often thought about that, really. That's leadership. When you knew what Reagan stood for, nobody had to tell you what he stood for. You understood that? Then we had a surging in crime. Your older members here remember. We had double-digit increases in crime in the 60s and 70s and in the 80s. People were upset. And Reagan was not elected to defeat the Soviet Union. That was probably a negative. People were afraid he'd start a war with the Soviet Union. What they elect him for is a strong man who was going to bring law and order to this country and end the disorder that was going on. That was a big part of the issue, just as Nixon had run on law and order successfully. And so we had increases in drug cases. You had violent crime was increasing. And so by the time I left the United States Attorney's Office, the marshal had 10 to 15 deputies. I'm not sure how many. The FBI had as many as 30 agents in Mobile. They didn't exist in the early 1900s. Customs, they did exist, but they'd grown to about 18 or more. The Drug Enforcement Administration, a new agency, had 5 agents. The Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Treasury Department had 5 agents. The Secret Service Treasury Department agency had about 5. The Border Patrol, 10. Postal inspectors and each one of the federal agencies had investigators. So this is really late. I'm just saying to you, the growth was significant. As an aside, I would note, if you wonder why federal regulatory efforts have surged so much, EPA got a 35% increase in their budget in 1 year last year. Year before last under President Obama. They ain't got nothing to do but harass your clients out there. They have to do something for the money that they get. So you go from the old cases. And we understood jurisdiction. It was interstate transportation of stolen motor vehicles. Interstate transportation. You didn't prosecute a stolen car case. It had to be transported in interstate commerce. Or there was the counterfeiting federal currency. You can't counterfeit federal currency. Interstate transportation of stolen property over $5,000. They have jurisdiction in federal court. Theft from interstate shipment. Now the railroads, you know. But it was a need. It was an interstate connection there. Gun violations were tied to the interstate transportation of it. Bank robbery of FDIC insured banks. That's a jurisdictional hook. Civil rights expanded some of that because there were clearly areas where civil rights type cases were not being effectively prosecuted, and that began an advancement where you didn't have as much of a direct interstate nexus, but you had some. The Postal Service, if you robbed a postman with a gun or with violence, 25 years in the slammer. Doesn't say up to 25. It was the toughest crime out there. Shall be sentenced to 25 years. It's still in the, Judge County, it's still in the code, I think, 25 years. And says something about the power of the postal lobby, maybe. But it was they out there by themselves, country roads, riding around, victims. And the word gets out, you better not rob a postal worker. And the inspectors were good inspectors who defended that. So I just would say to you, that's how we got there. Now we've got all kinds of things. Drugs, guns have been explained. The laws, in my view, many of them, there are too many that really don't need to be federal laws. And many of them are too complex. Do you remember the historic robbery statute? What is it? Forcibly taking a thing of value from the person of another through violence, a threat, or force, whatever. There were elements of the crime. For 200, 300 years, that's the element. Burglary, the breaking and entering an occupied or unoccupied dwelling with intent to commit a felony. Had to prove each and every one of those. The prosecutors, if they didn't have the proof of that, they didn't bring the case. If they didn't prove it, they were out. And now you end up with things like the Gibson Guitar Company, where the Lacey Act, where you're prosecuting a company and raiding the company based on the fact that the wood violated some law in a foreign country. We had one of those after I left the United States Attorney's Office in Alabama involving seafood being shipped in apparent in violation of another country's law. And it was a big national, it became a national deal. Back in my rural home, back in the country where I grew up, before they made it legal, I guess, it's quasi-legal, that kill alligators, after they'd stopped making it legal to kill alligators, as they'd always done. Manzie Russell was out. He had about 8 children. This big 13-foot alligator comes up the road. He goes and gets his gun and shoots it. Takes it to town. In the back of his pickup truck, Hollis Curl, a newspaper editor, comes out and takes a photograph of it and goes in the paper. And lo and behold, the Fish and Wildlife guy sees a picture in the local paper of an illegal killing of an alligator. So, I kid you not, he comes and investigates. And Hollis asked Mr. Russell, what about the alligator? Are you going to eat it? No, I'm not going to eat it. He said, well, I'd like to try it. I hear the tail's good. So he cut off the tail and took it home to cook it. The investigator now has got 2 people to charge, receiving, concealing, illegally killed game, and the man. And I really should get a copy of the newspaper article that Hollis Curl wrote. They appealed it, and he's still mad at me because I didn't completely get it thrown out. So they go off to someplace like Auburn, about 200 miles away, and they have a trial. And they come up with the court reporter and the clerk, and he describes all of them around the room, all trying to put Manzie Russell in jail for killing an alligator that was about to eat his children. I mean, you know, give me a break. So we're having a lot of that. I mean, really, a lot of that. Just some of the new statutes. One of the most dramatic, and I use the mail fraud statute. It's a powerful statute. Basically, the federal hook is if you have a scheme or artifice to defraud and you execute that in even small part by a mailing, then you've used the mails, a federal instrumentality, to commit your crime, and that gives the federal prosecutors a hook to prosecute you. And those cases became very effective in prosecuting public corruption and waste, fraud, and abuse, and fraud schemes of all kinds. And I've used it. And I'll just tell you, good prosecutors use every power they have. They assume that this is a crook and the Congress has given them the power, and then they use the power. The idea that they're not going to use the power is not a good idea. So you come up with... It kept pushing the law, and one of the deals was honest services. That's, and the Congress put it in the law. I mean, courts were saying that, and some were not saying that. It was unclear. The Supreme Court said honest services is not a basis for to put somebody in jail. What is that? So they pass it, and here it is. This is what the language was passed on, just a little amendment to overrule the court decision and add a new separate section to the mail fraud that includes a scheme or artifice to defraud to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services, close quote. Now, if you know what that means, I'm afraid they could put me in jail for that. And when the president announced that his budget would pay down the debt and cause us to live within our means, and the CBO said that the lowest single deficit it would occur in 10 years was $740 billion, is that... denying us intangible right of honest services? So you've got the Clean Water Act and the Migratory Bird Act and the navigable waters of the United States. We have really gone too far in a lot of areas. It is very, very important, and you'll hear more about it, I think, on your panel later on, but very important that we understand the federal government is a government of limited powers. If you pick up a rock in Alabama and you whack somebody and kill them, that is not a federal crime, and I don't think can be made a federal crime unless it's denying them the right to vote or some specific constitutionally protected right. It's just not jurisdiction. But we've blurred that. We blurred the... burden of proof, knowingly, willfully. Those are tremendously important. If you've been in court and had a judge charge a jury about what knowingly means or what willfully means, it raises a big difference in it. The malum prohibitum statutes have been abused. It's all right to have that. You have to have that in certain circumstances, but it should not be abused. People generally should know when they've committed a crime and are being subject to some significant punishment. So I'm glad you're here. Thank you for your interest in the American legal system, the greatest legal system the world's ever been blessed to see. I wish it were easier for us to transmit it around the world, but it is not easy, I got to tell you. We should celebrate and be proud of what we've got and protect and defend it with all our ability. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.